It's the Fun Drive Preview Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, light therapy, when sedatives fail, Ogopogo, vegetative consciousness, and more Catholic sex child abuse. Let's begin episode 141.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. And yet again, we spend a week absent, Jenna. Jenna, we hope you feel better and things go well with your surgery-type related stuff.
The wisdom teeth removal of therein.
And the removal of the wisdom teeth thing.
That's right.
Yes.
That makes a lot of sense.
No, well, I think we'll have a bit more about that later, because we do have a segment. Jenna has flown in from parts unknown.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, on that sort of medical theme, I was going through some of my notes. You know, everyone knows that I tend to listen to a lot of podcasts, and I do a lot of the research on the web just because I don't know, have anything else to do with my life, or that's my story. But I couldn't help but notice there was an article recently about how acupuncture can apparently cure chronic dry mouth for a certain number of people who suffer from a very particular sort of illness. I can't remember the name of it here, but apparently they did a study, and apparently acupuncture was supposed to reduce and remove the dry mouth that you get as sort of a side effect of this particular illness. Of course, I went to research into this because I hate to say this, but I'm a bit skeptical when it comes to acupuncture and the claims it tends to make. And of course, it turns out that it was actually a study of actually 86 patients. So it's more patients than I had originally. I thought it was only about 10, but it's actually 86 patients. But all the results were self-reported, and it was acupuncture versus no treatment. And they did have, you know, they said, well, you know, about twice as many people were cured, or half as many people suffered, I'm not sure how you'd word that, with the acupuncture than without. And I was just going, but I mean, these are self-reported tests. Again, you know, it's placebo versus not placebo effect. I mean, everyone knows that one of the neat things, if you know you're being given extra treatment, that tends to improve your conditions irrespective of anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And funny enough, they make reference that they did do some standardized measurements of saliva in this report, but they don't actually list what those measurements were. So in an odd sort of way, although people reported a significant improvement in their the way they feel and the way they approached it, they didn't actually supply any of the data saying, well, there was actually more saliva generated in these people than not. Now, of course, getting into the meat of the situation, that might be something that will come up in it. And they did have sort of the good caveat. They said, well, you know, if we're going to do the follow-up studies, and they always say, well, you know, we should do more follow-up studies, but in the meantime, this is a good thing to do, where they were going to compare sham acupuncture with acupuncture and a control group, which I guess was sort of a light in the tunnel. It wasn't quite all up there, but it just left me going, you know, this is going to get huge. Note, the acupuncture cures this, and we'll never see the follow-up studies on it.
Well, the thing is, if they tell people that they're getting sham acupuncture, that's going to prime them to have a negative reaction, because it's you're sort of breaking the double blindness of the study at that point. So they have to make sure they don't tell them, by the way, we're giving you the real acupuncture and you the sham acupuncture.
Well, and you also get the whole thing that, you know, if I am applying the acupuncture and I know what I'm doing is bullcrap, I mean, that's also going to be a variable in the whole equation, right? I mean, because the person, and we'll give them credit that they really think this works, the person doing real acupuncture will have a different mindset, you know, that they're going to be bringing into this, a more intense, more, you know, whereas the person doing the fake one, you know, might have a couple of beers beforehand, go, ah! Right? So, I mean, like, there are aspects to even trying to seriously study acupuncture versus sham acupuncture. But, I mean, I guess the attempt.
Yeah.
Although this has been, I mean, this has been studied many times before, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Acupuncture is one of those big pieces of alternative medicine that has gone through a lot of studies. You know, I think one of the pet topics of folks like Steve Novella is sort of acupuncture studies. And it's always fun to hear him kind of rant and rave about the latest acupuncture study and how it doesn't prove what it says it's going to prove. So I encourage listeners to follow that because it always is kind of interesting to see how they go about trying to establish something that, you know, has been proven pretty much time and again not to work. It's interesting, mental gymnastics, to say the least.
But the next one will prove it.
Well, they keep saying that. Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, the Star Wars sequel thing. Well, the first one was awful, but the second will be great. Well, the second one was awful too. Yeah. Third one will be great. And true. Then it's not.
Although on that note, I heard one of the most hilarious lines ever. It was on Big Bang Theory, and they were going to watch the Blu-ray edition of Star Wars. And one of the characters said to another one, "Hurry up and get here and watch this before George Lucas changes it again."
And he might, too. But that's a topic for another time.
Yeah.
Actually, we should tell listeners, next week is a very special episode of Radio Free Thinker.
What's so special, Ethan?
Well, next week we are doing our annual fun drive here at CITR. It starts on Thursday. So on Tuesday, we'll be doing the Radio Free Thinker edition. And we're going to be encouraging all you listeners out there in Radio Land to call in and donate and help CITR keep the lights on here. You know, there's lots of really good reasons. CITR is an independent campus community radio station. We serve a unique audience. We provide a unique voice out there. But there's another, I think, really important reason for us as skeptics is that, you know, there's not a lot of skeptical, critical thinking material on independent news. You tend to get a lot of kind of pseudoscience-y, kind of anti-establishment medicine reporting. You know, you look at sort of the Georgia Straits alternative medicine history. And I think that Radio Free Thinker is a great outlet for science-based medicine and, you know, critical thinking and skepticism that sort of is on the alternative side of the news spectrum. So we get a bit of a leg up in that sense.
So we criticize alternative medicine, but we praise alternative news.
Well, let's face it. I mean, the amount of corporate-owned news in Vancouver is kind of on the big side. And
actually, from what I understand, and one of our listeners may correct me, I believe Vancouver has the highest concentration of like single-owner media in the world. Well, mm-hmm. At least in North America. Russia might be worse. You never know. And that points out the thing is that you tend to get these sort of two variations. You tend to get the corporate media, mm-hmm. which will either A, worry about sensationalism, or B, sort of peddle a corporatist type line, or the alternatives to that, which are very few and far between, but they tend to be the woo fringe, you know, the Deepak Chopra sort of crowd that, you know, oh, well, if they say it's true, whatever they say, the opposite of it must actually be true because they're evil and everything they spout is evil. So science is evil and all that. So, yeah. So yeah, we recommend that people keep in touch, get their wallets ready, because not only will you be keeping CITR alive, more importantly, you'll be keeping our show on the air.
Yeah. And I mean, who doesn't love our show, right? I mean, come on now. And if you're listening by podcast, perhaps you live in a different part of the country or you're listening to us via one of our syndicated channels, you know, even supporting CITR and you live far away, it's still a good idea because they've given us this fancy booth, they've given us time on the air, and they've given us the ability to present our show across a wide group of people. So, you know, don't feel bad about supporting CITR if you live in Toronto or Winnipeg or Seattle. It's exactly. Always a good investment. You know, in 2009, our show raised $598.80. In 2010, we raised $573.80. So this year, we're really hoping to crack that $600.
Well, let's go for $1,000. Well, aim high.
Come on, folks. We always aim high.
We can do it.
We could certainly do it, but I mean, you know, we sort of got a trend here and, you know, it'd be really cool to break that $600 ceiling. So, listeners out there, consider donating. We're going to have some great skeptical-themed prize packs that are coming up, and we'll be announcing those over the next week. So stay tuned for that. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Did you know that 30% of students wander from one program to another only to end up dropping out? School doesn't have to be dull. Ktimovik is an informal learning program that offers students the chance to live away from home, explore new options, and learn outside of the traditional classroom. After finishing the program, most Ktimovik alumni return to university motivated and confident in their chosen program and ability to succeed. Visit ktimovik.org for more info or to sign up now.
The best tool ever devised for understanding the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So we have some interesting things.
We do.
Well, we always have interesting things. So can you cure the winter blues with light therapy? Seasonal depression or seasonal affective disorder, often referred to as SAD, which I don't know is either the most perfect acronym ever came up with or freaky weird coincidence.
I bet they had like a, you know, meeting to decide we need to come up with a name that can be, you know, comically reduced to a funny acronym.
Yes, yes. How sad. I mean, SAD, anyhow, can affect over 10% of Canadians in the winter as daily sunlight hours dwindle. Symptoms of your typical non-specific sort, you know, trouble waking up in the morning, tendency to oversleep, to overeat, to gain weight, lack of energy, difficulty concentrating on or completing tasks, withdrawal from friends and society. Now, of course, we should always be a little skeptical when we hear these sort of non-specific symptoms, because a lot of sort of false diseases, I guess I can call them that, will also tend to point to these sort of things. But SAD is actually recognized by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as a form of depression. So that's sort of the Bible of psychiatric care. So it seems real. I was listening to a segment on NPR Science Friday when they had a discussion on this topic. And since it's post-daylight savings time and ever-darkening evenings, I thought, it's kind of topical. So they honored their psychiatrist, Richard A. Friedman, on the show, who speculated that SAD was one of those evolutionary mechanisms to sort of limit our energy use when there's sort of resource or food poor times of the year, which seems to be sort of, you know, one of the accepted theories about it. It's kind of a human form of hibernation. So then he went on and they were talking about some of the treatments that you may have. And one of the ones was light therapy. Now, of course, when I heard this, my skeptical alarms went on and went, oh, wait a minute. You know, how can light do it? I mean, it seems obvious in some levels, but way too simplistic. And it's like one of those things you'd find in a naturopathic shop, right? So I went out and I checked, and apparently actually it works. It's one of those things. There are numerous papers who have done research into it and proved that they actually do kind of have an effect, and more importantly, there is a plausible mechanism for it to work. One, there's the circadian rhythm that it helps to rectify, and melatonin levels, which apparently will also go. And I'm going, great, great, I like that part.
So just to be clear, these are not just your regular old light bulbs. These are special lights to sort of simulate real sunlight.
Right. So they're light boxes is usually what they're referred to. Mm-hmm. And they have to have a certain intensity and a certain sort of frequency range to imitate a real sunrise. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that was one of the things, too. They do tend to be quite expensive. So yeah, their speciality is somewhat there. Mm-hmm. So you can't just turn on a light bulb and stare at it for a couple hours. You need to have a special thing. Although I have seen them available at like London Drugs and all that. But I suspect, as you're sort of hinting at, this is not the kind of thing that I would just walk into my local shop and pick it up and assume it will work. It would be something that I would need to know more about the details of the unit to make sure it delivers what it promises.
Right. You know, I actually have seen these type of things offered to help with sleep disorders. One of the things they suggest is that having an alarm clock that goes is really jarring. So they have these lamps that will slowly turn on to simulate the sun rising. And they think this is a more natural way to wake up. I mean, you know, the early articles that I've written sound, well, that's kind of sort of somewhat logical, I guess. Yeah. But I've never heard of any actual testing done if this actually helps.
No, I think where that would sort of have its difficulty is that on the one level, yes, a gradually lightening room will tend to make you more awake. But the flip side is people fall asleep during the daylight hours.
Yeah, that's
true. So it's not like we can't sleep. Whereas if you try and sleep with a loud noise going, you have to be pretty, pretty freaking tired for that to not keep you awake.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
But it's funny because, again, like I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this psychologist on the radio and I'm going, oh, well, that's good. And then he comes out with this one other thing where he says, well, you know, actually what's even more effective can be just a trip to the beach. I'm going, oh, well, that's neat. And then he goes in, and the reason why that is negative ions.
Negative ions?
Negative ions. He says there's lots of negative ions at the beach, and that's why it might even be better than light boxes. And I went, skeptical. Alarm number two goes off. So then I went and I did research into the negative ion thing, and actually I couldn't find anywhere that makes any correlation, A, with SAD, or B, any of the studies that actually have shown that this negative ion thing does anything other than it does have the potential to, can clean the air. You pass air through an electric field, will have the ability to pull stuff out of it. But as far as a means of changing one's chemistry,
yeah,
right, there doesn't seem to have anything.
I see. Why are there negative ions at the beach?
Well, it has something to do with the ocean waves hitting the surface. So it's sort of like a mechanical. From what I was getting, it's sort of mechanical. You have agitation of water, which itself is actually most water as we think of it isn't H2O. It's hydrogen and hydroxide that are sort of coming together, coming apart, going together, coming apart, and as such, it's I don't know, and he didn't really explain it, but
okay.
But there was some other interesting things though that came out of that. So I'm still quite doubtful about ion treatment therapy as a means for this. But did you know, apparently, and again, this came from the same doctor, so I guess I have to take it with a slight grain of salt, but there's a noticeable segment of the population that sort of has the reverse. So when sunlight becomes more plentiful, when summer comes, they also get sad. Apparently, this is most common in southern Asian countries and that sort of thing. And again, they have the same thing, but for the exact opposite reasons, which does lead into questions about the evolutionary psychology of the unit, but
Yeah. Well, so I guess the next thing to do would be, Don, tell us what else is going on in skeptical news.
Ooh, well, we're going to go to Jenna.
Oh, yeah, let's go to Jenna then. As listeners know, she's not here, so we have a pre-recorded segment that Jenna performed for us. So let's go to that now.
Hello again, Radio Freethinker listeners. Those of you who are extra astute may have noticed that you have not heard my voice chiming in with hopelessly witty banter as Ethan and Don explore the issues today. And those of you who are extra astute may remember that I was also absent from the broadcasting booth last week due to a fun experience I like to call wisdom tooth surgery. And those who are extra astute may have put two and two together and concluded that perhaps there were some complications that have led to my continued absence from the show. Those listeners would be right. So, brave listeners, I would like to tell you a story about the little maxillofacial surgeon that could. A story with the alternate title, A Tale of Anesthesia? So, some things in this surgery that I recently had went remarkably well. For example, I went into the appointment, as planned, with four more teeth than I left with. Well, strictly speaking, they actually gave me the rather gory extracted teeth in a paper cup, but I definitely had four fewer teeth in my mouth. I also left with a pocket full of rather delightful drugs, and went to a house full of cold jello and lukewarm soup. What didn't go so swimmingly was the anesthesia. Picture this. You're lying on a table, hooked up to a machine monitoring your vitals, and a doctor sticks a needle in your arm. He says you're about to drift off just like you've had too many margaritas on a beach, and then starts working away. But wait, there's pain, and you're awake, and you're being held down by the shoulders as your legs shake and you cry and yell and squirm on the table. They call for more drugs, but to no avail. They strap on the laughing gas, but alas, there is no laughter to be had. Four teeth later, you're sitting in a recovery room, bleeding, crying, and rather traumatized. It happened to me, dear listeners. But the question is, could it happen to you? As it turns out, there isn't actually much in the literature about failed anesthesia during dental surgery. Given the rather common nature of these procedures, I found this rather surprising, but was able to find one study that looked at the incidence of failed deep sedation and correlations with various conditions on the part of the patient. I was a little shocked, however, to find that my experience actually would have been deemed as successful deep sedation under this study, notwithstanding the fact that the sedation was not nearly as deep as I would have liked. The reason for this is that they had defined failure as the inability to complete the surgery due to either the patient combativeness or unsafe vital signs during the procedure. So perhaps if I had been lucid enough to kick my surgeon in the groin, I would have had a couple more teeth and a true story of failed deep sedation. So what is deep sedation? Deep sedation and general anesthesia are both defined by depressed consciousness or unconsciousness, including partial loss of protective reflexes. And such reflexes are like the ability to keep an airway open, to respond purposefully to physical stimuli, or oral commands, and I assume the ability to swat away sharp objects entering your oral cavity. So such sedation is accomplished through intravenous administration of a variety of different drugs or combinations of drugs. From my research, it looks like about 1% to 2% of all patients experience failure of such anesthesia. Although the study looked specifically at maxillofacial procedures like mine, only counted those where they were unable to finish the procedure. Criteria for failed anesthesia in other fields vary, so a direct comparison is pretty difficult to make between dental surgery and other types of surgery. The conclusions from the maxillofacial study were within this 1 to 2% failure range, however, and two main factors were suggested to be paramount in determining how a patient was likely to respond to deep sedation. The first is, unsurprisingly, pain. So local anesthesia, your run-of-the-mill freezing, is required along with the deep sedation to make sure that you don't painfully startle the patient into wakefulness. I quote from the study, "Painful stimuli in an already suffering and frightened patient are enough to arouse them from during deep sedation," end quote. As someone who recently was similarly aroused, the point here, though, is that the doctor is not able to count on the patient's lack of consciousness as adequate pain control, and very effective local freezing actually helps the effectiveness of the more general doping. The second factor that was perceived to be even more important than local pain control was the mental state of the patient. Anxiety was brought up again and again as one factor that can make deep sedation less effective. This is complicated by the fact that most patients choose the deep sedation option specifically because they are already anxious and are seeking to relieve said anxiety. You can see the circular logic here. The study authors urge offices to try and create a soothing environment, but somewhat comically concede that this can be rather difficult in the presence of the noise from a dental drill. As it turns out, that anxiety is such an issue in dentistry and dental surgery that there is actually something called the CORA Dental Anxiety Scale. And this is a questionnaire designed to assess the patient's attitude toward different dental-related scenarios. So I can only assume that this ranges from post-op jello eating to awaking screaming mid-molar drilling. The bottom line is that anxiety is a major contributing factor in the success of dental procedures in general. However, there's almost no literature on the correlation between prior anxiety and procedural outcome. So things that did not turn out to be much of a factor in anesthesia effectiveness were length of the procedure and pre-existing medical conditions. There are some exceptions with cardiovascular conditions, as deep sedation causes different responses in these cardiovascular systems. The authors also noted that experience of the surgeon could have something to do with it. Again, duh. Although there is some speculation about GABA-A receptors and alcohol abuse being contributing physiological factors, it is unsupported by evidence at this time, and they really don't know about any other underlying physiological factors, have them pinpointed to be able to determine how they might contribute to the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of anesthesia. So for myself, I can say that I'm glad I had a technically successful deep sedation experience, that I wish I had had a subjectively successful deep sedation experience, and hope to be back in the booth with the guys soon. In the meantime, remain calm and always bring your anesthesiologist cookies. Back to you guys.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Wake and awake and awake. Search.
Sadly, that is almost all I know of my own language. Because Indian residential schools impacted generations of both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. Now, our generation welcomes you to witness Ignite the Light on Friday, November 18th, a multimedia collaboration of film, poetry, and music on our collective history of Indian residential schools and social justice. Friday, November 18th at the W2 Media Arts Center, 111 West Hastings. Childminding will be available. Please email your RSVP to ignitethelight2011@gmail.com. Louis Riel said, "My people will sleep for 100 years, but when they awake, it will be the artists who give them their spirits back." Join us to ignite the light.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks to Jenna for giving us that great little bit. I hope that she is feeling better soon.
We all hope she gets well soon.
Yes, because no one likes being, you know, stuck in bed with a sore mouth.
Unless you're afraid that you may be eaten by some prehistoric monster lurking in a lake in Canada.
Yeah, that is a possibility. What Don is alluding there is there has been a possible, a possible Ogopogo sighting. That's right. Recently, a man in Kelowna, Richard Hools, saw something strange in the waters of Okanagan Lake. Could it be the mythical lake monster known as the Ogopogo? Has it at last been captured on film? Well, maybe not. The video shows what appears to be a dark line moving through the lake that sort of looks serpentine, or possibly two logs in a row. Either way, the possibilities are exciting. Well, you know, not the log one, but the other one is good.
Yeah, no, serpentine.
Yeah. So what does Hools think he saw? Well, according to the article on Global BC, he is quoted as saying, "It proves something is down there. Whether it's Ogopogo or not, it's a different story. But there is something, at least, down there. It was not a wave, just a darker color. The size and the fact that they were not parallel with the waves makes me think that it was something else." So, what's interesting about this article is that at the start, there's a disclaimer that says, "CHBC News regrets the attribution to Richard Hools that he saw the Ogopogo. Rather, Hools claims to have seen an object in the water and does not know what it was."
Ooh, so kudos to Richard for being a good skeptic. He saw something, but he's not jumping to the conclusion that it has to be a prehistoric monster out to kill everyone in Vancouver.
Or Kelowna.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, Kelowna.
Yeah, it could have swum down the Fraser, I suppose. Yeah, actually, that is pretty cool. It's nice to see that. I guess the news sort of jumped the gun a little bit by attributing to him that he'd seen a lake monster. I don't know if you've seen the video. I saw the video, actually, and I take
issue with you saying it moves in the water. But it's in the one location. You can see the waves kind of going over it.
Yeah.
But it seemed pretty parallel. And I'm going, you know, if that's something that's supposed to be alive, it seems to be not moving. It seems to be not moving.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of, that's why I kind of thought it was like a couple of logs, because it looks like the waves are moving around it. Now, the article also quotes Rob Young, who is an environmental science professor, who said, "I think I'm looking at a standing wave. As the lake is warming and cooling, the temperature variations will be causing different layers, and the layers, as I say, with some minor disturbances, will start to flow or will start flowing past each other. And you'll get that sort of rolling action where the two layers pass each other." So if you look at the video, and it's about 30 seconds, you can kind of see this discoloration. And I think it looks like a couple of logs, but I'm not a scientist, I don't know. You can also kind of see what looks like a branch sticking out of the water about, I don't know, maybe 5 feet away, that's also not moving. So that's why I'm kind of thinking it's like a tree or something that fell in the water, maybe.
Well, and you know, that does go with the whole idea of credulity, right? I mean, yeah. you sit there and you say, well, you know, we occasionally do see what I would call sort of pseudo-cryptic animals, you know, like elephants or rhinoceroses in Java, right? I mean, we know they exist, but you almost never ever see them. But there's a good reason, right? Either they're late at night or they're the places you never ever go to. You never get these sort of things happening in lakefront property where there's a big buildup, right? Mm-hmm. If this was really Ogopogo, then we would have seen him before. I mean, if he comes up to shore and he's like this, then it seems to me hard to believe this is the first time it has ever done it in sort of the history of the lake sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, also just sort of the kind of massive discrepancy you get between sightings. Sometimes he's like you said, sort of like a, what do you call those things, a paleosaur?
Plesiosaur.
Sometimes he's like a big snake. This was like a big snake.
Yeah.
Doesn't really match the dinosaur style version of him. So, you know, you kind of get these really strange things. I mean, unless you can conclude that there's like a family of really weird cryptoids living in this lake, all different shapes and sizes.
And let us not forget that that is more plausible than it being a log submerged underwater.
Yeah, well, you know, logs, they'd never go in the water.
never, and we've never found any in water either. So, I mean, there's been no evidence of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of finding evidence.
Yes.
Scientists have discovered consciousness.
Wait a second.
Okay, so it's not quite as mundane as that sounds. EEGs have been used to find consciousness in people who are in a vegetative state. A vegetative state is a clinical condition of complete unawareness of self and the environment, accompanied by a sleep-wake cycle with either complete or partial preservation of the hypothalamic and brainstem autonomic functions, i.e. they can breathe and their heart beats all on their own. In addition, patients in a vegetative state show no evidence of sustained, reproducible, purposeful, or voluntary behavioral responses to visual, auditory, tactile, or noxious stimulus, i.e. if you make some bad smell around them, they will ignore it. Mm-hmm. Make some nice house guests. And they show no evidence of language comprehension or expressions. I'm taking this directly from a medical journal that's explaining how you would as a diagnosis. They have bowel and bladder incontinence, which I guess would be an obvious sign that something's wrong. And have variable preserved cranial nerve and spinal reflexes, i.e. if you tap them on the leg, their leg will do that little spick-up thing. And they must be in such a condition for at least a month. So the idea here is, it differs from brain death. Brain death is where there is no neural activity in the brain and you're kept alive because there's a heart-lung machine attached to you. This seems to be just, there's no consciousness there. There's no person there.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a study where they had 16 people who were in this persistent vegetative state, and along with 12 healthy control subjects. And what they did is they told them to imagine you're kicking a ball, right? And, I mean, obviously, the vegetative state people, we assume, heard. We don't know they heard. And, of course, we have our controls. And what they did is they measured the EEGs of the people who were doing this mental exercise. And there's a part of your brain that will light up if you are thinking about doing these particular things. It's kind of like mirror neurons, but slightly different. And then what they did is they discovered that all the 12 healthy people did it, the control subjects did, but they found that 3 out of the 16 also had this very same thing. And this is actually a follow-up study to one that they had done before where they used fMRI machines. It's those big, fancy X-ray machine, kind of, but they're not X-ray machines, where they, again, they discovered that some of the people who are in these vegetative states would actually respond, if only in a mental way, mm-hmm. To these verbal suggestions. In fact, they have one person where they can actually kind of communicate yes or no answers by using this sort of language, which is interesting. So, this is like, wow, you know, there are these people that are still there, even though they have no way to communicate. But it becomes important because, unlike with brain death, the family can sit there and they can request the doctor to, you know, let them die with dignity, right? But with these vegetative state individuals, it becomes a lot grayer now. I mean, one of the assumptions was before is that, you know, their animal brain was still alive, but their higher functions, the things that make them human, were gone. They were dead. And so really keeping them around was kind of like having a pet in an odd sort of way. You weren't doing it for the person. You were just sort of doing it for the family, drain on resources. But now, as it turns out, there may be somebody still in there, mm-hmm. which leads to a lot of interesting questions.
Well, you mentioned that 3 of the 16 had these responses to the initial, like, imagine you're kicking something, and then they discovered brain activity in 3 of them?
Yes.
So, I mean, like, that's still pretty a low number. Is there a benchmark here for when it's just random? Does it happen randomly, or can they determine that it's because of the stimulus?
Right. So, again, this is a follow-up study to one that they did with fMRIs.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, again, it was not a random correlation. So it wasn't a one-time trial, right? They did it for different things, and it was a consistent, I say this, you get this response.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't washed out by random random things. So in a way, they've kind of proven the premise of this beforehand. But one of the big issues with using fMRI machines is it's very, very expensive to use, and the logistics of getting a vegetative person to an fMRI is quite expensive. So this EEG machine allows them to sort of do this quick and simple test. And it has been discovered in the past that a number of people who were diagnosed, in quotes, as persistent vegetative states weren't. It was either misdiagnosed, or the brain is such a bizarre area to do, especially when you deal with the higher functions. Some people sort of recover from it after right. a certain period of time. And it's believed, at least one of the theories, is that it is not so much that the higher functions are destroyed, it's just their ability to activate the body has been interrupted, and that on some occasions that can actually be cured. Of course, as you pointed out, 3 out of 16 still means most of them are gone. I mean, most vegetative states are initiated by blunt force trauma through a car accident or something like that, or apoxia, I think is the right word, where they have a stroke or they're drowning victims and, you know, not enough oxygen getting to the brain. So, I mean, it's not like we're saying, hey, they're always there. But this does appear to be an interesting case where you can do some form of test to say there does appear to be somebody home.
Mm-hmm. And this is also different from the sort of locked-in syndrome where you are conscious, but you can't communicate it because you're essentially paralyzed.
Right.
Right. And that's where you have the sort of facilitated communication, either the sort of pseudoscience-y kind of one, and also the, I believe Rob actually talked about this a couple times, the eye-tracking movement type stuff.
Which, again, and I love your skepticality, Ethan, about this, because, I mean, they have done this. They've done two studies at least, one a bit more intensive than this one, that does seem to show that there is a response. But you are right. A lot of this is subjective. Like, for example, this one patient that they have where they say they can get sort of a yes-no answer from, I would be skeptical about how accurate the communication is because, again, there's no real way to test it unless this person spontaneously recovers, in which case, oh, yeah, I was there all the time and I know exactly what you were saying, which, oddly enough, I think means that he was misdiagnosed and wasn't actually in the state.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I was thinking of, I mean, so you have on the one hand, if there's somebody in there, then we shouldn't allow care to be refused from them because there's still a thinking human being inside of there. But then I was thinking to myself, well, if I was in that particular state, I might not want to stay in that state. And we have this discussion. In fact, I think in a court case today, there's a woman who has ALS who's gone to the BC Supreme Court who is trying to fight for the right for assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And what if you did start communicating with one of these people, rare people, who happen to be able to communicate, and they said, please, just let me die with dignity.
Yeah.
How would that work?
And I mean, plus, like, how would they be able to communicate it in a way that clearly indicated that this was their intention, right? If it's just sort of like, oh, their brain lit up a little bit, like, that's hard to go on, right?
Yeah. And it's like, so would you kind of not want to maybe have your life extended but not in a current manner way? And they go, yes. Yes to what?
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of these things can be very complicated. But in another area, and again, you're kind of hinting at this, is a response equated to consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe in some of these people, it is sort of the equivalent to a reflex. You know,
yeah.
If they hear these particular words, right, they have sort of the reflex of wanting to do the action. We talked a previous episode about the Stroop effect, where words will override a color of a particular text. And that's not really a voluntary thing. I mean, it's, I guess, in a way, a sign of consciousness, but not really, because you don't have really any control over it, or very little.
Yeah.
And what if this is just another one of those sort of artifacts of that soul process?
Well, the other thing, too, to keep in mind, like when we were talking about sleep and dreaming a few episodes ago, we were discussing just how little we know about the brain and higher brain functions. I mean, we're really just scratching the surface with this. I mean, so this is like a really fascinating result, and I'm very curious to see where this goes, but it's so early, and just our ability to explore these questions. So it's just really hard to infer from this what we would do in certain situations.
Well, and as you say, because there is the other part, is out of the 16, 13 of them, I guess we can apply, have been now written off.
Yeah.
You know, as in, we've done a test, there is no one there, and we no longer feel guilty if we do something to that. And as you say, that might be just jumping the gun a bit on the other direction.
Absolutely.
So, speaking of jumping the gun.
Yes.
Well, no, I have no guns to jump.
Okay.
But we do get to kick on the Catholic Church again.
Woohoo!
In southern England, the Catholic Church Child Safety Coordinator was charged, who was in charge of investigating sexual abuse allegations, was jailed 12 months today for internet pedophile offense. He was found in possession and distribution of over 4,000 images, including a dozen or so that are level 5 images. Level 5 images, for those who don't know, it's based sort of on a classification of child porn called the Copine scale. Copine is Combating Pedophilia Information Networks in Europe. The rating rates images between 1 to 10, where 1 is sort of non-erotic, non-sexual pictures in a, quote, context or organization indicating inappropriateness, to 10, which is sort of sadism and bestiality. Mm-hmm. England itself has sort of scaled this down to 5 levels. They kind of dropped some of the lesser ones and grouped them a bunch together. But again, level 5, sadism, bestiality, not nice things. Christopher Jarvis, 49, who was a married father of 4, investigated historical claims of child abuse, interviewed victims when they were adults. He was responsible for child protection of 120 church parishes and community groups over 9 years, and was a member of the Devon and Cornwall multi-agent safeguard team, having access to police and social service information about victims and that of child abuse. As a result of the conviction and sentencing, the Roman Catholic Church has ordered a review of its child protection across southwestern England. Duh.
Yeah.
The offender himself, besides being immediately fired, was also kicked out of the church. And somehow in the story that I was reading, this was like some human interest angle that they were trying to get into this. But they would not allow him to attend church again unless he signed a covenant of care. And this he refused because his lawyer had stated he had decided now that he will not go to church. The lack of forgiveness is very difficult for him to deal with as a man of faith. Oh. Again, boo-hoo.
Yeah.
We could go all into the Catholic Church and its child abuse, but I thought it was kind of interesting, this whole covenant of care. I haven't actually heard that term before, so I thought I'd do a little checking into this, right? I mean, there's not a lot here, but there's a bit. So apparently it's an agreement between the clergy or parishioner who wants to remain a member of the church, who's been alleged to have committed abuse, and the bishop or congregation leader himself. It's a written agreement to ensure the public protection and over the course of time that the person will basically get some treatment and some help. I read this agreement over a bit, and on the one hand, it's kind of what you would expect to find. You know, the abuser will never approach its victims ever. He's not to be alone with children, yada, yada, yada. Essentially, he promises to be a good person. On the other hand, though, I couldn't help but get the feeling when I was reading this that it was just one of those legal documents that companies, in this case the church, came out just to cover their butt in case he reoffends. And they can say, well, it's not our fault this time. We had it all covered. Mm-hmm. And of course, regardless of that, I mean, would you really trust this individual with this document? Sure, he signs the paper. But, I mean, let's not forget that he was the one responsible for investigating child sex abuse in the past. And I cannot believe that at some point, he had to sign a document that had to say something about, I don't know, like, if I become firmly aware of an individual possessing or distributing child porn, I will immediately report that individual to civil and church authorities. I mean, at some point, that had to have been something he had to sign.
Yeah.
And he signed it, and he just ignored it because he was the person in question. It strikes me, I mean, and the church, in its defense, it said that he was a fully qualified social worker and came to the role following a competitive recruitment process, being of good character and of very good references.
Who did they turn down for this role?
Well, you have to wonder, right? And I mean, it goes with this whole, I don't know. See, in this case, I mean, I think the church does help proliferate this, but I think he sidesteps the normal, you know, let's bash on Christianity bit. Because, I mean, he was associated with the church, but he wasn't a priest. So that whole celibacy, I mean, he had children, he had all that, right? But this was almost like, you know, an institution that wanted to be willfully blind, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or said, well, we need to do this because the law says to, or the culture says to. But we're going to do it in sort of a technocratic sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And not really understanding the full gist behind it. I can't help but compare this to another story that's been big in the news recently, Penn State.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
And you had, what was it, one individual, Mike McQuarrie, who walked into the shower, saw another of the coaches, or former coach, I think, at that time, but another coach, Jerry Sandusky, raping, as he put it, although having sex with, I guess, a 10-year-old child.
Mm-hmm.
He goes and reports it to Joe Paterno, who is a superstar when it comes to American football. And Joe Paterno does what he's supposed to do in a very technocratic way. He reports it to his superiors and leaves it at that. And I was listening to one of my podcasts, again, Slate Political Gabfest. And they had on there one of the commentators who was sort of taking this very, well, he followed the letter of the law, therefore he is not responsible, morally responsible for anything that happened. And the other two people were going, what the hell are you talking about, right? I mean, one, this was one of his friends, and how could you be friends with someone mm-hmm. that you now are aware of is a pedophile who rapes little children in showers that you let him in here? And he just said, well, again, technically he was supposed to report. We don't know what was in the report, so maybe it was watered down to, you know, not to be defamatory, right? And again, it just struck me as Penn State missed the whole point of these laws. I mean, it's not to be a checklist that some bureaucrat can file away in a cabinet. It's to protect the children.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And if you fail to see and do that, it's...
You know, I mean, I've been listening to a lot of sports podcasts. I'm a, you know, sports fan, as people know. And this has been coming up a lot. And I think there was an article, I can't remember exactly where I heard it, but it was written by a pretty well-respected sports commentator. And he was saying that it is, like, laughably insulting to suggest that the other coaches and staff and bureaucrats in the university system didn't know this was happening. They all must have known it was happening. There's no way for them not to have known it was happening. And likewise with the church. I mean, obviously, the Pope was freaking in charge of making sure this didn't happen. This pedophile was in charge of tracking down pedophiles, who he himself was. I mean, it is so laughable to assume that there's some kind of just terrible mistake on the part of these organizations when it was... What it comes down to, it was just sort of this "I don't care" attitude. This kind of "let's leave it be and hope it goes away."
Well, and that was one of the things that was brought up about the paternal idea was that, well, he told his superiors,
mm-hmm.
and at that point he could walk away from responsibility. But again, for us who aren't into the sports area, it's hard to assess at how much he was actually in command. Apparently, it was in 2004. The leadership of Penn State Football Association, whatever, went to his house to fire him, and he said, "No, you mm-hmm. can't. I'm not you. I won't let you." So, I mean, it's not like, even though technically he may have done what he had to do, it doesn't let you off the hook. And again, just because you've assigned someone to investigate sexual offenses, right, which the Catholic Church had done,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that, okay, he's responsible for that. I no longer have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Which, again, seems to be kind of what's happened here.
Well, the other thing, too, and I guess, I mean, like you said, we can kind of go on this for hours and hours, but the few things that immediately jump out at me is, one, the whole notion that this is caused by celibacy, that Catholic priests have taken this sort of unnatural vow and can't control their animal instincts, so they rape children, is bullshit. We know that from this. You don't become a rapist by abstaining from sex. You are a rapist who perhaps abstains from sex in some cases. And the notion that religion, any religion, somehow makes you more moral, and that as we've kind of heard from many sort of debates and Christian apologists, that it's their faith that keeps them from doing bad things, seems to be indicated that actually their faith seems to protect them while doing bad things. It's kind of, well, horrifying in many ways.
Yeah, well, and again, you get this sort of weird confluence. I mean, because, again, another recent scandal has been with the Boy Scouts, right? And mm-hmm. Granted, most of their offenses were decades old. But, I mean, see, I would disagree with you. I don't think celibacy causes pedophilia.
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the opposite.
Right, okay. Well,
no, I mean, I'm saying that celibacy is not an excuse for...
Right, okay. You know. But at the same time, I think certain professions will tend to selectively sort of have a preference for it. Again, Boy Scouts is the easiest one. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you sit there and you kind of know there's something wrong with you, you may think that, you know, if I become a priest and I just rule that whole part of my life out, I will somehow be able to conquer this. And like an alcoholic with drinks, no, it doesn't. So it's not, again, a causal relationship. But there does seem to be a filtering. And there have been a number of studies, I thought, that have kind of shown that in repressing one's sexual urges amplify, exactly. Yeah. So someone who is going to be a wife beater or something like that, you may at some point have that sort of pre-programmed into you. But if you come from a home where spousal abuse is common, there is a correlation then that will make you more likely to be a spousal abuser. It doesn't mean it caused you to be, although maybe it does, but it definitely means it increases your likelihood of exhibiting that particular trait.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you are a pedophile, there are certain professions to go into that would give you easy access to your desires. You know, like a priest, a Boy Scout, troop leader, whatever.
Right. And of course, it strikes me as odd that if you wanted a legal reason to look at child porn, investigating child porn would strike me as a perfect fit job for you.
Apparently.
Why do you have all this porn on your computer? It's research for my job.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time here on Radio Free Thinkers, so let's go to our skeptical highlights.
I've got one here. Apparently, there's a big push on now to try and boycott some restaurants in Vancouver that serve shark fin soup, shark fin other things. Anyone who's seen anything to deal with how shark fins are harvested, if I can use that word, from the ocean, it's absolutely atrocious what they do. One, sharks themselves are an endangered species because they're very slow reproducing. Two, they capture the sharks, they hack off their fins and then throw them back into the sea, which one is wasteful, and two, you could argue, slightly cruel. Mm-hmm. And three, it's shark fin. I mean, really, do we need to have shark fin? Is it that important to our lives that we have to have it? So there's this big campaign, and I was looking at it, and there are a lot of restaurants in Vancouver that serve shark fin. I didn't think we were that trendy.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, and we're going to have the link on our show notes, but it is important with any kind of boycott that you don't take the list at face value. There's one actually restaurant here on campus that apparently serves shark fin soup that I'm highly dubious that they do. So I would say if these places, check them out. Check their menu. If they have shark fin in the menu, if the waiter says yes, we can get that for you. Boycott their ass. Mm-hmm. Other than that, don't eat shark fin soup or rape children. Both very bad.
Yeah, that's good. Good skeptical highlight. I'll just give a quick shout out to two things. Of course, our fun drive is coming up next episode, so stay tuned for that. And a quick shout out to Skeptics in the Pub. There is one tonight at the Railway Club at 7:30. So if you're in town, got nothing to do, come on out for a beer. And if you like Skeptics in the Pub, find us on Facebook. We have three different ones in the Vancouver area. There's one in Kitsilano, one in downtown Vancouver, and one in Richmond. And come out to Skeptics in the Pub at some point and say hi.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, well, we're out of time on Radio Freethinker. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on. And for Jenna, the real world is amazing.
And hopefully she'll be back next week. So long, folks.
It's almost that time of year again. Fun Drive 2011 is coming. November 17th through the 24th, keep 101.9 on your FM dial and your eye on CITR.ca for updates on all our fantastic Fun Drive events. Mark your calendars for November 25th, because we'll be releasing details soon about our raucous Fun Drive finale party. Help keep your station at the top of its game by making a donation during Fun Drive. Call 604-UBC-UNIT or check out citr.ca/fundrive for more information.
That's what I want.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.